always just really liked being able to work directly with the land and use my hands to accomplish things that I could really see in the world.
And you learned some skills there that really stood you in good stead when you applied for a job on the Sun Ranch near Yellowstone.
I did, absolutely. I don't think I would have ever gotten the job, ever gotten the chance on the Sun Ranch without what I did on the Zenses place. So I owe them a great debt for taking me through that completely useless initial help that's not help kind of phase.
There's a point in the book where you talk about the job description for the Sun Ranch job, and the qualifications that they wanted were, quote, common sense, adaptability, and gumption.
Yeah, gumption. I still use that now when I put together announcements for ranch hand positions when I'm hiring people. Jeremy,
gumption is definitely called for, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and it's kind of a hard quality to pinpoint, to put your finger on, but you can kind of tell if somebody has it or doesn't. and Jeremy, the guy I worked for on the Sun Ranch, he was the foreman there. I think that putting that on the job description was probably one of the smartest things he ever did, putting that together.
And Jeremy was one of two mentors you had on the ranch. There were Jeremy and James, who, like you, were ranch hands. There, Jeremy was in charge. And Jeremy was an interesting character because you think of ranch foremen, you have this kind of idea of them, but he's somebody who watched Democracy Now.
And yeah.
I think, God forbid, probably listened to public radio.
I sure hope he did. I mean, I know he did. You know, Jeremy and James both are interesting characters. And interesting people in the real world. You know, we sort of have this idea of the mythic West and the cowboy out there. And I don't know that really exists. You know, we're all just sort of individuals trying to make our living in a hard landscape. And I think that draws interesting people, and it causes people to become more interesting and develop strange, wonderful idiosyncrasies while they're out there too.
You said in the book that one of the things you learned is that most of the living things on the ranch are either, quote, with you or against you.
Certainly that's the way it feels sometimes. I think a rancher has to walk a very, very fine and difficult line between feeling that way, that, you know, certain parts of the natural world are your friend and certain parts are your enemy. You have to balance that with the knowledge that the entirety of that system, that functioning natural system, that is what allows you to do your work and make your living. And at the end of the day, all the parts of that working together are what sustains your livelihood.
You love the work.
Yeah.
And you also talk about, quote, I was living at the center of my heart's geography.
That's very true. I've always loved the work. You know, I love some parts of it more than others. And, you know, this is kind of a strange thing maybe, but for example, I've always loved tearing out fences more than I like building them. I did love the work. I really responded to it. And there was something about the ability to touch the natural world, to affect it, to change it, that really clicked with me. And part of that might be because I grew up in art galleries, and the cardinal rule in an art gallery is you don't get to touch anything. And that was always a tough thing for me as a kid, you know, seeing these beautiful things and not being able to really interact with them the way I wanted to.
You also say that ranch work is a mixture of beauty and brutality. And that is so well, I think, described in your book. There are some scenes that are wonderful in their beauty and scenes that are repulsive in the brutality.
Yeah, yeah. It's another one of those fine lines to walk. And it's a tough one because of the two, brutality is certainly the easier one to ape for a person. And I think, you know, in many ways, the greatest test of a rancher or a ranch hand or anybody that makes their living with animals and on the edge of a wilderness, the greatest test is, you know, how well can you walk that line, and to what extent can you choose to yaw a little bit closer to the beautiful side of things and stay away from the magnetism of the destructive, brutal ones.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of contradictions in the life, aren't there, Bryce?
Sure.
One of them is how the ranch hands love the livestock because they see them as something that they're there to protect at all costs. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a scene where there was a recalcitrant cow, number 512,
who
didn't want to go to a pasture.
Right.
And there's a scene where James, the cow is down, and James takes a rope and beats the living daylight out of the cow. And then they drag the cow with the rope, and you think the cow's going to die.
You know, that was the first thing I'd ever seen that was really like that. And it was certainly a difficult thing at the time and afterward. But I think a person also has to understand context. And, you know, one of the things that I think was going on in James's head, and certainly would have been in mine if I'd been in his position, is he'd actually seen the horrible results of leaving a cow behind once. He left one behind and it got on a highway. Actually, a guy he was working for did this, got on the highway and a motorist hit it and it killed the motorist. And so these things build up in you and you feel this pressure that's
leaving
more...
Leaving
the cow was not an option for a couple reasons. You know, what I just mentioned and then also the fact that it was a landscape full of predators, and in some ways leaving her would have been basically offering her up as a sacrifice to leave her alone and move the rest of the herd on.
The other big theme of the book, of course, is that you're living in wolf country. And as you said, it's on the edge of the Lee Metcalf Wilderness, and there was a pack called the Wedge Pack that was living there when you were there. One of the first inklings you have of the kind of regard that local ranchers there have of wolves, you were talking to the matriarch of a local ranching family, and I want to read what you wrote about her, and you said, quote, "When I told her I didn't own a rifle, she stared at me as though I had revealed a deep-seated, appalling vice. Looking down from the saddle, she fixed me with a hard, appraising glare. It got to me. For a moment, I was ashamed to be a man of 23, presenting myself as a ranch hand with just a shotgun to my name. As she watched me think this through, her face softened just a fraction. Tell you what, she said. If you need a gun, you call me."
I mean, I think there's certainly a lot in there, you know, because there's a definite strong stance with regard to wolves, but there's also a certain kind of deeply hidden warmth about the way she responded, too.
She wanted to be helpful, but she also thought you needed a gun if you're going to be around wolves.
Right. And she wanted to be helpful, but she wanted me to make sure I was on what she thought of as the right team. And I think that's one of the things that people may struggle with this book is that, you know, I've always had a difficulty choosing sides in this. I have a deep appreciation and a love for the work and the life of ranching, but I have an equally deep sympathy for wild animals like the wolf. I think that's a good position to write from, but I think it's a difficult one for a lot of people.
And really what happens on the ranch is that as the pasturing changes over the summer, you keep moving the cattle deeper into what is the wolves' territory. And that is when things really begin to get dramatic.
Right. Although it's not as simple as, you know, pushing a log toward a fire. It's, you know, the wolves were constantly moving through the landscape and the cattle were cycling through too. So there was a sense of inevitability about it. And as the summer matured and the grass was greener higher up, our margin for error grew a lot thinner.
And eventually it broke and the wolves started eating some of the heifers.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really strange to have that happen because for me as a city kid, I did love ranching, but more than anything else, I moved there to be close to the wilderness, to be close to wild animals like the wolf. And so to be put in such violent conflict with them was a really strange thing for me.
And you ended up shooting a wolf. You describe how your attitude changed at some point. At some point, you went from being thrilled about the wolves being there to being angry at the wolves for what they were doing to the livestock that it was your job to protect.
There's a lot of ambivalence there, you know, a lot of inner conflict, I think. And, you know, I found myself sleeping out with the cattle, trying to protect them, sort of running myself down that way, not getting enough sleep. And yeah, it's difficult. You become invested in these creatures, these livestock, because we've bred this race of innocents, you know, big, you know, happy, fat innocents. And we turn them out in some of the wildest country in the world, country with teeth. And then it's very difficult to not feel like you owe them some level of protection. And that's a really hard thing to balance with your desire not to kill a creature that you really respect. So mm-hmm. It was a very hard thing for me.
You write about the aftermath of killing the wolf.
Sure.
And at some point, you and James and Jeremy are hauling the wolf out of where you killed it.
Yeah.
You say, quote, in the book, "I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that I had taken something that floated through the forest like a spirit and reduced it to dead weight and a fecal smell."
Yeah, that was a really difficult thing to square with. I had a friend ask me later, you know, how do you get over something like that? How do you get over, you know, crossing a line that you didn't think you would cross? And I don't really have a good answer for that. I mean, I think, you know, maybe the best the best way to sum it up is that, you know, time passes and you do other things, but at the same time, you know, I won't forget what I did, and the reasons for it have always been kind of complicated for me. It's one thing to say, yeah, it was my job and I had to do it because I had to protect these cattle. But I think that doesn't cover the entire situation.
You go on in the book to talk about the changing landscape in terms of the future of ranching and the future of wolves, because eventually this pack was killed, the whole pack,
sure,
because of the conflict with cattle. And then you write about how the owner of the ranch, a wealthy man, but still having trouble keeping the ranch going and having it be self-sustaining. And so at some point he thinks about selling a few parcels to some millionaires as a way to keep the ranch viable, the rest of the ranch viable. And that is a conflict that's playing out in many, many parts of Montana.
And that's where I think we get into something really, really interesting, because, you know, we've been fighting this wolf thing for a while, you know, kind of tearing each other's throats out over the thing. And I guess I would contend that, you know, no matter what happens on a ranch like the Sun, with cattle and wolves, you know, I think we're better off if that place stays open, which is to say, you know, we will lose cattle and we will lose wolves, and that will keep happening. But if we can continue to try every year to do it better, I think there's real hope and real potential. And I think if a landscape becomes developed, if it becomes fragmented, I think that hope for the future winks out pretty much instantly. Because
for the cattle and the wolves.
For the cattle and the wolves, yeah. And the people that have made their living there in a sustainable way, or what we hope is a sustainable way. So I honestly believe that we need to have a working landscape, and some level of conflict, some level of bloodshed between cattle and wolves may be inevitable, but I think it's a whole lot better than losing the whole landscape to fragmentation.
Here's what you wrote about that. Quote, "The interests of cows, wolves, and elk would collide with the desires of millionaires. When they did, our stewardship of the land would suffer. I felt my job, life, and purpose on the ranch sliding into obsolescence."
Mm-hmm.
"And so I decided to leave." And you did leave.
I did. And I guess I'd want to, you know, say one other thing about the way Roger, the guy that owned the place, approached it. You know, I think he very reluctantly looked at that as an idea.
And felt he had no choice.
Yeah, and I don't mean to set it up as, you know, ranchers and conservationists against, you know, millionaire recreation buyers, because it's not that way. It's, you know, collectively we have to stitch together a landscape that works. And the only thing I know for sure is if you put too many houses in it, it quits working.
Bryce, this is one of the best things I've read about the complexity of the conflict Montanans feel about wolves since they've been reintroduced. So I much enjoyed the book, and I've been speaking with Bryce Andrews, who's the author of Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. Bryce, just a wonderful read, and I wish you best of luck with the book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.